and thank you all for standing by. At this time, all lines have been placed on a listen-only mode throughout the duration of today's conference. Today's conference is being recorded. If you do have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Sheila Wiener. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to today's National Kidney Foundation Coffee House Conversations telephone series call. We're so happy you're able to join us. I'm Sheila Wiener, Patient Services Director with the National Kidney Foundation. And today's call, What the New Rules Mean for You, is the first call in a series of four about the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services conditions for coverage for end-stage renal disease facilities. While we did intend this call for patients and their loved ones, we do know that professionals have registered as well, and we welcome you on the call. We will hear from our three expert faculty panel members today, and each of them will speak for 10 to 15 minutes. And following their three presentations, we'll open the session up to questions. Our first speaker today is Dolph Cinciano, and Dolph is the National Kidney Foundation's Vice President for Health Policy and Research. Dolph has worked with the National Kidney Foundation for 29 years, and he is responsible for health policy and research. Dolph is also a member of the New York Bar Association and holds a master's degree in public administration. Thank you, and welcome, Dolph.
Good afternoon, everybody. The conditions for coverage are the requirements that dialysis clinics must meet in order to qualify for payment under the Medicare program. State survey agencies conduct site visits at dialysis clinics on behalf of Medicare to make sure that these requirements are being followed. The new conditions for coverage that are the subject of this series of coffee house conversations were effective October 14th this year, updating regulations that had been published more than 30 years earlier. Unlike the earlier regulations, the new conditions for coverage require dialysis clinics to meet specific performance expectations for patient care. A preliminary version of the new conditions for coverage was circulated in February 2005, and the kidney community had 90 days to provide suggestions for improvement. The National Kidney Foundation Patient and Family Council was active in providing comments on that regulation when it was published in draft form. In addition, NKF has played a critical role in this policy development, providing a member of the NKF staff to work with Medicare on the interpretive guidance for the new regulation and to work with Medicare to train state surveyors so that they can understand the implementation of the new policy. The conditions for coverage are only one of many changes that the federal government has put in place recently to improve the quality of care for and the quality of life of dialysis patients. These include the Medicare conditions of participation for transplant centers and the dialysis provisions in the Medicare Improvements for Patients and Providers Act of 2008. Dialysis patients have often told us that they have not been informed of their status on the transplant waiting list. However, the transplant regulations that I mentioned and that went into effect last June require transplant centers to inform individuals on the waiting list as well as their usual dialysis facility of their status and document that communication in the patient's record. In addition, the transplant centers must have written policies and procedures for ongoing communications with dialysis patients' dialysis facilities. And finally, transplant centers must also provide their patient selection criteria to transplant candidates or dialysis facilities whenever requested. The Medicare Improvements for Patients and Providers Act of 2008 makes significant changes in payment for dialysis services and includes provisions to enhance the quality of care in dialysis clinics. A total performance score will be assigned to each dialysis unit based on measures for anemia management, dialysis adequacy, patient satisfaction, iron management, bone and mineral metabolism, and vascular access. Medicare will require that the total performance score for each dialysis clinic be posted in the unit so that patients are aware of this evaluation. Every unit's total performance score will also be available on the Medicare website. Finally, payment to dialysis clinics will be adjusted in accordance with the total performance score. As you will learn from the next speakers, there are parallel provisions in the new conditions for coverage for dialysis facilities, reinforcing the government's commitment to improved patient care. Thank you.
Thank you, Dolph. That was an excellent overview and introduction of the conditions for coverage, and you certainly made a very complicated topic more understandable. I'd like to welcome now our second speaker, Glenda Payne. Glenda is the end-stage renal disease clinical lead for the Dallas and Atlanta offices for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And Glenda oversees the ESRD surveys in 13 states. Glenda is involved with teaching state surveyors how to conduct ESRD surveys and has helped with the development of materials for the new conditions for coverage. Glenda will speak this afternoon about the role of the surveyors and how that works in the dialysis unit. Glenda, thank you very much and welcome.
Thank you, Sheila, and thank you, Dolph. I've enjoyed your presentation as well. And you've set a good stage for me to talk about the conditions of coverage and the change from the old conditions for coverage, which are the rules that we expect dialysis facilities to meet in order to be eligible for reimbursement. These rules don't have anything to do so much with how much people are paid or what they're paid for, but whether they're paid at all, because we, CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, do expect at least a safe and effective treatment to be provided to all patients. And as Dolph has mentioned, CMS is moving more to an environment where we are expecting better and better outcomes for our patients. And those outcomes are going to be facility-based as well as individual patient-based. So while that one total score for all those outcomes that Dolph mentioned will be looked at when we're deciding about how to pay facilities, when surveyors from our states go into facilities and inspect the facility for compliance with these rules, each individual patient record is supposed to reflect the efforts of the team to attain and sustain those particular outcomes, both in anemia management and adequacy, as well as in vascular access and bone and mineral metabolism, patient satisfaction with their care, etc. So this is a different focus. Our old conditions of coverage, which were in effect until October the 14th this year, those were much more a process and structure-oriented type of conditions. After all, they were written 30 years ago, and they were really before the age of outcomes measurement and before the age of quality improvement. So we, the survey staff that are being educated now in how to use these new conditions, are very excited about the potential that these new rules have for improving patient care. Sheila mentioned that I work as a sort of an overseer, if you will, for surveyors in 13 states. I just look at end-stage renal disease facilities, which include transplant centers as well as dialysis facilities. But surveyors in those states also use rules that are related to hospitals and home health and hospice as well as dialysis centers. So many of the surveyors are trained to look at lots of different provider types. They use specific rules for each type. The survey process all the surveys that we do are unannounced. So the facility or the hospital or the home health agency does not know that the surveyors are coming until the surveyors arrive. Once the surveyor enters the facility, they do inform the people in charge what they're there to do and how long they'll be in the facility. With a dialysis facility, generally that's at least 2 full days. So it's possible as a patient or a family member that you will see a surveyor come into your clinic. The things that surveyors do while they're in the clinic are to observe the care that's being delivered, to interview patients and staff, and to review the records of care to be sure that the quality of that care, again, provides a safe and effective treatment for those patients. If you're asked to be interviewed by a surveyor, they will ask your permission. They will also try to provide as much privacy for you as possible. If you're comfortable being interviewed in the treatment room, that's great. If not, you can ask for the surveyor to talk to you after treatment or to call you at home or make an appointment to meet with you elsewhere. We really value the information that we get from patients and families. You're the ones that are there all the time. Certainly everything changes when an inspector walks in the door, whether you've got a great clinic or a not-so-great clinic, and we really appreciate the viewpoint that the patient provides us. We do collaborate the findings with multiple sources, so we do protect your privacy from the point of view of no surveyor would take information that you give and use just that as the basis of a deficiency. Now, what's a deficiency and what does that mean for the facility? A deficiency is written any time the facility practices are not in compliance or don't match what the laws require, in this case the regulations require. The most common things that are written are things like breaks in infection control, which means while the surveyor is observing care, he or she sees that staff members are maybe not washing their hands or using hand hygiene every time they should, or perhaps not changing their gloves in between going from a machine to another patient. The staff may not be well trained to do their assigned jobs, that perhaps someone's assigned to do reuse of dialyzers, but they haven't been well trained in that and they're making some mistakes in the way they're doing it. Our patient care plans might not be updated or might not be individualized for the individual patient. The old regulations required something that was called a long-term program, and we actually had a question about what is the long-term plan for home dialysis, hemodialysis patients. And I'm not sure if this was the reference, but there was a form that was required in the old regulations that was called a long-term program, and many people call this the long-term plan. And essentially that was a way to address treatment modalities, the choice that patients have about the way that they are going to be treated, whether that's by hemodialysis in-center, home dialysis, either peritoneal or hemodialysis, or perhaps transplantation. In the new regulations, there's no requirement for that paper document any longer, so the words long-term program are not in the new regulation. There is a wealth of places in the new regulation where the choice of modality or the choice of how you will be treated within the different options that you have for kidney failure, that choice is addressed. The other areas I'd like to cover with you today include the fact that you should know that these new conditions do address many different components within the dialysis facility. And over the next several weeks, we'll be having additional calls where we do discuss some of those other components. For instance, the physical environment, which includes things like temperature control, and there is a new requirement that the temperature be adjusted to keep the patients comfortable as well as to address the needs of the staff. Many times we find staff are wearing cover garments and now they have to wear cover coats or gowns rather than aprons, and that tends to make the staff hotter than the patients who are being dialyzed. But we expect that the facility address the needs of both the staff and the patients and achieve a comfortable temperature. Patient safety is also really a focus of these new regulations, and that will be addressed, again, more in detail in further conferences, as well as your rights about grievances and complaints. The regulations require that the facility have an internal system to address complaints and that they make every patient and family member aware of that system as well as an external system where the patient or family member could contact the network or the state agency if there were an issue that they felt the facility did not address. We encourage patients and families to use the internal system first. And if that's not functional or does not result in the outcome that you wanted, then to go to one of the external options there. I think I'll stop and let Celeste go next, and then if we have questions, we can come back to those.
Thank you, Glenda.
Sure.
Your overview was extremely helpful, and we will look forward to hearing more on the future calls about the additional topics in the conditions for coverage. I'd like to welcome now our third and final speaker, Celeste Lee. Celeste is the chair of the National Kidney Foundation's Patient Family Council Executive Committee, and Celeste serves on other NKF committees as well. We keep her very busy here. Currently, with a membership of more than 30,000 individuals with chronic kidney disease, Celeste and the other executive committee members represent the voice of people affected by chronic kidney disease. Celeste received a non-living transplant in 1986 and was on peritoneal dialysis for 10 years, and now Celeste receives in-center hemodialysis. And Celeste will talk to you about how you, as patients and family members, can be empowered with the information that you're hearing about the new conditions for coverage. Celeste, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Sheila. And thank you, Dolph and Glenda, for trying to communicate a somewhat complicated agenda item. But I'd also like to thank you all for taking part in this call today. So first, what I'd like to talk is, now that you've had a chance to listen to both Dolph and Glenda, to give you an overview of what the Medicare conditions for coverage are, selfishly speaking, what I really wanted to talk about with you today is what do they actually mean to you and to me and to our loved ones and family. And as Dolph and Glenda had mentioned, the main goal of these conditions for coverage, or I'm going to shorten that to CFC just to make it a little easier, is to improve the quality of care for patients. And more importantly, and this is what I think is crucial, is to provide consistency of care across U.S. dialysis facilities. But I would also argue that they also pose the question to how can they help us educate and empower ourselves? How can we use them to help us become our own best advocates? So given that Dolph just discussed the settings of standards of care throughout the country, what I use these CFCs for myself when I was looking at them and reviewing them is to look at ways that I could find opportunities to better understand my own treatment, my care, and ways in which I could search to educate myself and my family, and thus becoming my own best advocate. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to list just some opportunities that I think these provide us, tools, if you will, about how we can communicate with our healthcare team and what that means, what that might look like. Give you some examples of I actually spoke with some folks and colleagues who are on the Patient Family Council to get some of their experiences that I could share those with you. And, talk a little bit about that and then open it up for questions, because I think sometimes you all will have the best questions that maybe we hadn't thought about. So let me start with one of the first rules, or one of the first opportunities, and this is what excited me quite a bit, is we have an interdisciplinary medical team within a dialysis unit, hemodialysis specifically, which is your doctor, your social worker, your dietitian, and your nurse. And they actually all need to do one is when a new patient comes into a unit, they actually need to give an assessment of that patient. But more importantly, they also need to do care planning. And the care planning is, I think, and I actually use it myself, it's a wonderful opportunity to actually have all of your members of your care team in the same room at the same time discussing just you and your treatment, and also giving you the opportunity to voice any concerns. And what this can do is this allows you to, you know, you want to prepare for these meetings, and what they're going to talk about is they're going to teach you, especially if you're new to dialysis, they're going to teach you a new language. And even if you've been on dialysis for a really long time, they're going to teach you about what your adequacy is. What is adequacy, right? And that is, you know, they may use the word like KT over V, which really is your clearance. And what does that really mean? It's your dialysis treatment, it's your dialysis prescription. It's basically saying, how well are we cleaning your blood? You know, how effectively are we doing it? It could be so many different factors that affect that. It could be the amount of time you're on dialysis, whether you're being compliant, meaning maybe you kind of skip a couple treatments or you get off early. But you all can talk about that together, and you can get a better understanding of what that means, because the units are going to be very vested in the sense that they need to make sure that they're keeping up with your adequacy and that your prescription is beneficial to you. And you may not realize that taking 5 or 10 minutes out of your treatment, you know, once a week or three times a month is not that big a deal, but it adds up over time. So that's something that the doctors and your healthcare team can talk about you. It also means that it gives you the opportunity to understand your lab values. And more importantly, as far as I'm concerned, it also gives you another reason to build a relationship with your care team, because your care team are the people who are going to be knowing you the best and can help you go through the process of being a dialysis patient, which isn't easy. And we all want to be able to have relationships with the people who care for us, and that we actually are a person. And sometimes in a dialysis unit, it feels that it can be a little impersonal, and these team relationship or meetings allow you to actually create a relationship with your care providers. It also, you know, another effect of having these meetings and building a relationship is that sometimes when we're on dialysis, and I think all those who are on dialysis are family members of those who are on dialysis, we know that when you're not feeling well or you're having a bad run or your blood pressure is pretty low, we don't always put our best foot forward. And sometimes we can be short. Sometimes we can be not disrespectful, but just short and frustrated. And so by allowing us to actually build this team beforehand when we're feeling better, when we're not on dialysis, I think it allows for better outcomes as far as patient satisfaction and also staff satisfaction, where we all get along. So I think that's something that is, as much as we can see each other as people and know each other's hobbies and dreams and hopes, where we can't always get that type of information as a doctor rounds from chair to chair to chair, during these team meetings we might be able to do that, which is really define it and create it as a team. another factor or opportunity that these provide for us is actually the opportunity for education and treatment options. You know, and just as Glenda had mentioned, it really is about equaling choice. What is our choice? And, you know, the CFC rules ensure that each one of us, someone who's new, someone who's maybe been around for a while, but we all have the requirement to be able to know what are our options of modalities that are available for us as dialysis patients, whether that's home hemo, in-unit hemo, PD, transplant, what do they mean? And, you know, how is it that we best use this to educate ourselves? And what I wanted to share with you is one of my other patient advocates was talking to me. I'm going to share with you. She wrote me something. I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to tell you why I think this is important. She said that she was interested in home dialysis when she had to restart hemo. She had a transplant, and it had chronically rejected. And so she was at her clinic, and they were educating her on what they had to offer as their treatment. And they had basically given her conventional home hemo with the specific type of machine, basically being three times a week or nightly, or short daily dialysis, or PD. But there's a special machine that's called a next stage that she was never educated on, and she would never have known about this machine unless, you know, because she's actually, she works in the field, so she understands what these machines can do. And anyone else like me, like if I have no idea what this machine is, I would not even known it existed. And so she searched and found out who offered it, and she ended up switching units and drove 2 hours because this machine was something that she truly wanted to use, and it was her choice. And she knew that she's going to have to change her dialysis unit, but that was okay with her because this modality was so much better for her. So I think what this shows is that we should know about all the different types of alternative modalities that are available to us, because what's good for me may not be good for you, but what's good for you may not be good for the person sitting next to you, and we all just want to have those choices in life. And choices when it comes to a chronic illness and chronic treatment like dialysis is just not only choice, but it's also empowering. It's also hope. It allows us to find out what fits our lives the best, what makes us feel the best. And so the fact that every patient has the right to know what's out there is, I think, is crucial. The other example is that there was a patient who was interested in doing PD, but unfortunately her certain circumstances in her life were not allowing her to do that, and so she had asked her facility if she could at least learn about it, and they said no because the doctor said she wasn't a good candidate. Well, that's not good enough. Every patient still has the right to know, because if they understand why they wouldn't be a candidate, maybe they could make some lifestyle changes that would allow them to become a candidate for that, such as, you know, learning how to stick with sterility issues and having sterile technique and being able to do the technique at home and not get make themselves prone to infections. So I think it's crucial that we all have the ability to be educated, and we all have the right and choice to have the treatment options that are available to us. And one other thing that I really wanted to talk about is Glenda had mentioned the folks who come in to possibly be surveyors. And this is something that I can impart on you all that I think is crucial, and that is being your own best advocate also means being your own best surveyor. So as you're sitting there in your chair in dialysis, to be able to watch how a renal technician or dialysis tech does your dialysis treatment, i.e., cleans your arm if you have a fistular graft, prepares your permacath, to make sure that they have sterile technique. And these folks work in this environment daily, 6 days a week, sometimes some of them are 7 days a week. And sometimes they can let the sterility or the sterile technique lapse a little bit. We'll go to someone's machine and come to your machine without putting on new gloves, or not putting on gloves at all, or not putting on a mask, or coming at you with your permacath without a mask and not a sterile gown. We just need to make sure that you know exactly when you're in the hospital, or you get out of the hospital and you have a new fistula, or you have a new graft, you ask your family or you ask your doctor, what is it that I need to let them know when they're caring for me? What size needles do they need to use at first? How do I keep myself safe? What do you recommend? And ask your doctors and your nurses to tell you that, so that you constantly can be vigilant in your own care to make sure you protect yourself, because you're your own best advocate. And so with that being said, like I said, I want to leave time for us to talk about this. But I'm gonna leave you with something that my physician told me when I was 17 and I had just been diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. I'm now 43, so I've been living with it a long time. But this is what he said to me. He said, "Celeste, I cannot cure you, but I can help you feel better, and I can provide you treatment that can assist you in leading a full life. However, you are the master of your own destiny. You say when, you say where, and you say why. You say no, or you say yes. You will be your own best advocate, and as the years go by, the most familiar with your needs. Be prepared to voice them strongly if necessary." So I leave you with that, and I'd be really happy to answer any questions, Sheila.
Thank you, Celeste. I love the examples that you use to help people understand the importance of building relationships, learning about their treatment options, and dealing with challenges and frustrations. And if the individuals on today's call listen to the future calls, you'll hear more about how you can work with your dialysis care team and care planning, and learning what you need to know about being on dialysis. Well, I think we'll take this opportunity now to open the session up to questions, and actually to introduce this session. We did invite people who registered for today's call to ask questions and to send us their questions via email, and we did receive a few calls, so I would like to take this opportunity to share the one question that we did have, and Dolph will provide us with a response. And this individual asks, when are they going to change the laws or rules and let people with end-stage renal disease who have Medicare join a Medicare Advantage plan, like an HMO? And while that doesn't exactly relate to today's topic about the conditions for coverage, we would like to provide a response.
Well, thank you, Sheila. Actually, dialysis patients can now join Medicare Advantage special needs plans thanks to the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003. HMOs, however, are not yet making these plans available in every market. And for some time, transplant recipients have been able to join Medicare Advantage plans as well. Just one note of caution, and that is that patients who join a Medicare Advantage plan may not be able to secure Medigap insurance if they decide that they prefer the original Medicare. I think Catherine Paikin may have some additional comments.
And if you think transplantation may be in your future and you get into a Medicare Advantage plan, read the small print very carefully. There may be limitations or restrictions on your ability to get a transplant in the manner, the place, the timing that you'd like, because Medicare Advantage is an HMO, and it's not, you're not free to use just any doctor or hospital that you like. Okay. Well, we will now begin our question and answer session. Please feel free to ask your questions, and we'll do our best to provide responses.
Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question over the phone lines, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Again, to ask a question over the phone lines, please press star 1. We'll give it a moment. Our first question comes from Jan Whitaker. Your line is open.
Thank you. I am calling from Shreveport, Louisiana, and I am a social worker. I was very interested in the new patient's rule, having the doctor, nurse, social worker, dietitian, et cetera, there. I think you said something about the patient needs to be included in that particular meeting now. Is that correct?
This is Glenda Payne, and the new regulations don't speak specifically to exactly how the patient assessments and plans of care will be developed. It's expected that it would be an interdisciplinary team, and the definition of interdisciplinary team is more collaborative than, for instance, a multidisciplinary team, and an interdisciplinary team works together and concurrently rather than sequentially. So it means they're doing their work at the same time, whereas a multidisciplinary team might take a piece of paper, for instance, and pass it around and each person write on it.
Right.
An interdisciplinary team wouldn't do that because they would have talked about the patient or talked with the patient and with the other team members.
Correct. That's the way we do it now. I just thought of something
else. That's a great way to continue to do it.
Okay, and I have one other question. I'm trying to see exactly what the surveyors are looking for in the charts in our notes, and do the surveyors come to survey on Saturdays or weekends?
Well, the surveys are unannounced, and in dialysis clinics, the surveys are generally done Monday through Friday and generally done sort of regular business hours, like 8 to 5. But if there's an issue or if there's a facility that might only be open, it's not likely they'd only be open Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, but if there was a complaint, for instance, that there was a problem on Saturdays about staffing or about training, then the surveyor could deliberately show up on Saturday and start the survey then.
Okay.
And your other question was
what kind of things are they looking for in general that we should have available to them and that should always be there in the charts or in the notes?
For your notes, essentially the surveyors are looking in the record to see that the ordered care and the needed care are delivered. Mm-hmm. So that information could be documented in orders, in laboratory work results, in progress notes, in the plan of care, in the assessment, and in the treatment record, as well as in individual discipline progress notes. I think as we go forward with these new regs, we're likely to have the nurse, the doctor, the social worker, the dietitian all charting on the same form, because it'll add to the, it'll make the communication easier.
Well, actually, we do our notes in the computer.
Right.
So that's why I'm wondering. See, I was doing them in the chart, and they changed it to the computer. So
right.
I am trying to see. I mean, they can get to them if they need to.
Right.
But that's where all my notes are. Is that a problem?
No. The whole world is changing to electronic records. And we're all sort of in different phases of that. And our concern with an electronic record is that you could get to the social worker's notes as well as the dietitians,
correct,
the doctors, and the nurses.
Correct.
And so each one of the team members can get to all those notes, and that's great.
Okay.
The patient should have access to the record, too, if they need to see a particular part of the record. They should have a legitimate claim to see that record if they need to.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Glenda, could you say a little bit more about the role of the patient in the care planning process and what the new rules say about that and how that might be different from the old regulations?
Sure. And I think Celeste did a great lead-in for this because her comments about this is a way that you can empower yourself by taking an active role in that care planning process. I've been a surveyor for a long, long time, and I've surveyed in lots of different states, and by far the majority of patients have not been involved in care planning. And I think a lot of that is because it was not presented as a positive thing, and it was not made not only not convenient, but sometimes inaccessible. Like the care plan meeting might be on a day when you don't come to the clinic for dialysis. And I've been to clinics where they had a group of clinics and they had all the care planning meetings at one, which might be 30 miles away from your own clinic. So I think there have been all kinds of reasons that patients have not necessarily been involved. But I think going forward, as I mentioned just now, the intent is that this be an interdisciplinary team, which means that all the team members, the patient, the doctor, the nurse, the social worker, and the dietitian, work together to make this the most effective care delivery we can. Our goal is to have better outcomes for patients. That means not only that you live better within your treatment modality, but you also live longer and more healthy. So the patient's role is really to participate with that team, to listen to what their concerns are, and to express the patient's own concerns, to try to work out a way. Celeste, for instance, mentioned that you might not understand that shortening your treatment a few minutes here or there made a difference. But maybe talk about, okay, if I come Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and on Wednesday I have an appointment that I really have to leave early, is it possible I could dialyze a little bit longer on Monday and a little bit longer on Friday to make up for that fact that I have to get off early on Wednesday, so that you consider the fact that what you do as an individual patient has a direct impact on how your treatment works out for you. Obviously, as Celeste mentioned, you are really in control of your destiny. You have charge of yourself, you know, probably 85% of the time, and only less than 15% of your time is spent in a dialysis unit. And you certainly have charge of yourself there, too, to a certain extent. So unless you join with the team in collaborating with goals as far as your, for instance, mineral metabolism, that has to do with that nasty old thing called phosphorus and calcium, and how in the world do we manage to control those things without the patient's cooperation, because it has so much to do with diet and so much to do with taking binders when you need to take them or other medications. So these regulations are different from the old ones in that they do have expected goals for things like mineral metabolism or your calcium and phosphorus. And if you don't, if an individual patient doesn't meet those goals, the team is expected to look at the care plan and decide, okay, what could we do differently? And a big part of what they need to do differently is to involve the patient in that plan so that you as the individual patient can see, oh, I understand now because you've taught me what I need to know to be able to cooperate with this. And it's not about who's in charge and who's telling me what to do, but it's about me taking charge and doing the right thing by myself so that I don't have the complications of terrible bone disease or terrible cardiovascular problems that end up causing my heart to not work correctly. Is that kind of what you meant, Sheila?
Oh, very helpful. Thank you, Glenda. And also I want to mention that our third call in this series will address in more detail the care planning process and how all of the interdisciplinary team members are involved in that. I think we're ready now to take another question from our audience.
Thank you. Barbara Breckenridge, your line is open.
Yes. When you spoke about having the team and the patient discuss the modalities, once they get to the dialysis unit, they are already set up for hemodialysis. So were you speaking of pre-education when you talked about the team working with the patients about the modalities?
That's an excellent question. Glenda, would you like to tackle that one?
I can start. The regulations that we've been talking about really only apply to the dialysis facility. They don't apply to the hospital or the physician's office where that patient might have been seen before. And while I agree with you that some element of choice has already been made, the facility, the dialysis facility, still has a responsibility to educate the patient and be sure the patient is educated about the options that they do have. And certainly, transplantation is not frequently given as the first option, although it does happen, but it, certainly patients that are beginning their road as a kidney disease patient need to know about the option of transplantation. Also, home dialysis might not be initially provided as the option in the doctor's office, but the dialysis facility has the responsibility to let the patient know about that option as well. And these conditions actually require that the facility provide information about transplantation and home treatment. The home treatment option is, even if that facility does not offer home treatment, they are still required to provide patients with that information. And if the patient is not a candidate for either home dialysis or transplantation, the reason why they're not a candidate has to be documented. So, and it can't be just, I don't want to give them that information. It really has to be something based on a reality for that particular patient. Does that help you?
Yes, it does. But most times, by the time they get there, they've got the fistula and they've got the graft. Sure, they could do home dialysis with that, but in the meantime, if they have been pre-educated, they could also choose some of the other modalities.
Well, I agree with you that in the best of all worlds, patients would be educated very early on and would be helped to aim their path, so to speak, at whichever modality they are choosing. However, and we are working on that, the Medicare Improvement Patient and Providers Act that Dolph mentioned at the first of this presentation does have some monies in it for pre-dialysis education of patients, for chronic kidney disease patients. So there is a program that will be starting to try to educate patients and do more about education before patients come to dialysis. But even the patient who comes to dialysis, just like Celeste, in part of her introduction, you know, she's been on dialysis, she's been transplanted, she's been on home therapy. Most of our patients that live a number of years with end-stage renal disease have a multitude of therapies. And it's just being sure, again, these new conditions require that we make sure that every patient does know about all the options.
As Glenda said, the Medicare Improvements for Patients and Providers Act create the new benefit for pre-dialysis education for people with stage 4 kidney disease who are also Medicare beneficiaries. That coverage is effective January 1st, 2010, and we're working with CMS on the implementation of that benefit.
And just to add to what Doc said, the National Kidney Foundation agrees that the education is important, as you have brought up, Barbara, as early on as possible. That's why we've been working very hard to get this legislation passed. Okay, why don't we take another question?
Thank you. Richard Cooper, your line is open.
Yes, I guess this question is for Celeste. What I wanted to ask you was, I have, for the last 2 years, been running a support group for the National Kidney Foundation. And what I'm hearing you talk about is how patients need to be aware of what's going on. And I think with these support groups, this is a great benefit for anybody that's going through transplantation, dialysis, or just wants general information. And I guess my next question is to the social workers, because what I'm finding here in Pittsburgh is I actually personally go into these units myself and try to get this information about these support groups passed on to the social workers at the clinics, and I just get no response. And I think this is, as far as education, this is the best way to go.
Okay, so what's your question again, though, so that when you...
I guess the question is, I'd like to see the Kidney Foundation itself spend a little bit more money as far as giving us some support as far as running these support groups for the people that are on dialysis or had transplants. Or I have many members aren't even there yet, and I've educated them because I have been through it all myself, so I can educate them and give them the information that I've gleaned and other people in the group have gleaned. And it just doesn't seem like the Kidney Foundation is doing enough to promote these support groups.
Richard, this is Sheila. I'm the Patient Services Director, and I agree. You know, we can never have enough support groups, and all the resources we can afford these groups is helpful. And I think that in your support group, certainly we would encourage you to talk about the new conditions for coverage so that patients can be empowered and they can then empower others to learn about their treatment and their treatment choices and to get involved.
Well, yeah, I would hope to see that there would be some way that these support group leaders can get this information, because obviously we're not getting it.
Well, you know what? We encourage you to participate in the next 3 calls and maybe even let your other support group members know about these calls. And we're happy to... And our plan is actually to provide ongoing education about the conditions for coverage, so it won't end with these calls. We're going to have information posted on our website, and these audio sessions will also be available on our website after the calls. So please feel free to let others know about them. Well, thank you, Richard, and we'll take our next question, please.
Thank you. Mike Zach, your line is open.
Yeah, I really welcome this the facility. I wanted to talk about several issues which and find out how they will impinge upon these new criteria beyond the technical delivery of services. I'm concerned about the environment in which the services are delivered. Where the facility I go to now has a lot of Spanish speakers. Some of the people speak or understand Spanish, and some don't, and that limits the interaction between patients and staff. So I was wondering how that might be. That is a qualitative indicator in terms of the environment. The second thing is the former environment. I live in Northern Virginia. the former dialysis center, which I was for 3 years, is in a building. It's a very old facility and had a plumbing problem from the story above where the thing got flooded. And as a result of that, they dispersed us all around the universe, and I found a new facility with a different company. And I must say, again, it's an environmental issue. It's not necessarily safety, although it could be safety. I feel much better where I am now. I feel comfortable that I'm not going to get stuck at the wrong point. I'm not going to get hurt. It's this new facility where you're put on, and we're in pods of four, and we have the latest machines, which the other units did not have, which are computer controlled, which meant that the machine took the blood pressure every 15 minutes, and the other one, they had to wake you up every 15 minutes to jerk you around to take your blood pressure. In the new facility, as a result of having these machines, they shut the lights, they dim the lights, and you could sleep for 3 hours if you wished. The other place, you had no sleep, no rest, nothing. Environmentally, very different. Yes, you're having dialysis. Now, in this new place, when they woke you up, this is around 9 o'clock as I go first shift, they would come around and offer you coffee to drink, which was very nice. Just an environmentally friendly atmosphere, which made you feel welcome. At the other place, you couldn't drink anything, you couldn't have any ice cubes, because the medical director thought, well, if there was hot coffee, you might burn yourself. Now, these are not medical issues, but they are environmental issues. In the former facility, I never felt safe. I never felt secure. In this current one, I feel very much safe and very secure because basically they were trying to please. I won't even, and I have confidence in this in the new facility. I won't tell you what happened for Halloween because the other place, the social worker basically put out some cheap dollar cookies. This new one, they had catered stuff, and they also had the staff dressed up in Halloween outfits during the treatment. Again, and they asked the patients to participate in the process so that they would select a patient who won something. Very different attitudes, very different companies. The quality of the environmental indicators were very different. I'm very happy where I am. The first one was very primitive, and I'm wondering whether any of these factors will be taken into account in these new surveys. Thank you.
Can I answer that?
Yeah. Can I just say something first, Celeste?
Sure.
I just want to thank you, Mike, because you've raised some really important issues, and I think what you're speaking about, if I can sum it up to some extent, is quality of life and patient satisfaction. And actually, patient satisfaction will be measured, and that's a requirement in the new rules. And the things that you're speaking about are directly related to patient satisfaction and quality of life. Celeste?
No, I just wanted to say it's not only quality of life, but patient satisfaction is something that's really crucial to these conditions for coverages in the survey. They do take that into effect and or into account, actually. And I do think that the environment in which we do dialyze is crucial to our well-being. It's somewhere that we go three times a week. Some people go there a little bit more than that. It's places that you want to have a very happy environment, a collegial environment, a comfortable environment. One that you don't dread going, one that's clean, that's not dirty, that's not cluttered, that's not depressing. All of those things are crucial to improving our care. So, thank you very much, Mike, for bringing that up.
What about the issue of language?
Yeah, this is Glenda, and I'd address that and say that the new regulations require that the patient receive information, all information, in a way that he or she can understand. So there is an expectation that for common language, like you're saying Spanish, and generally across our country, Spanish is a common language that would be considered a foreign language, but is in many places almost the language du jour of that, or at the time of that particular facility, that there would be ways to communicate with that patient. Either someone there speaks Spanish,
or they have materials in Spanish, or they have a interpreter that's available at all times, either by phone or, again, a staff member that speaks Spanish. So it's, I don't mean that there must be at all times a staff member there that speaks Spanish, but that has to be, that information that the patient needs has to be provided in a way that they can understand. So that's an expectation. The other things that you mentioned as far as the environment, many of the examples you gave I see almost as customer service, which certainly make people, would make me feel more comfortable, certainly would make any patient feel more comfortable in the environment. When you talk about feeling safe, I think some of the things you mentioned make the patient feel safe because you feel like you're more a part of the group rather than separate from the group. There are requirements in the new regulations for something that's called life safety code requirements, which means that the management of the facility has to look carefully at the facility to see that they meet all of the fire codes and all of the safety codes so that the building itself is constructed and maintained so that patients could be evacuated quickly if they needed to be and that appropriate procedures could occur quickly in the event of an emergency in the facility. So that's all new too. So the patient satisfaction things that Sheila and Celeste both mentioned are critical, I think, and then the safety things as well as the information in a way that all patients can understand. All those things are addressed in these new regulations.
Finally, I would like to know if you guys could post on the NKF site where I could read these new regulations. And I want to thank you very much for your help today.
Thank you, too.
We'll take our next question.
Pamela Du, your line is open.
Yes,
I had a question about Medicare. A lot of our patients come in with Medicare only, and they're past the 6 months. What I understand, the regulations say that they have to apply for a supplement within 6 months of getting on Medicare. And I've never understood that and why that is true. Is there any other way we can get them on another supplement?
Is it Pam? Was it Pam?
Pamela.
That depends upon local state law. Some states have other requirements. And the reason why the insurance companies do that is that they obviously are trying to make sure that people buy the insurance before they are in need for expensive care. So you, what state are you calling from?
Texas, and it's Vicki.
Vicki?
Yes.
And Glenda, do you know anything about Medigap policies in Texas?
No, I really don't, Dolph, but if Vicki would like to email me, I could send her a question to somebody who does.
Okay. What was your name again, please?
Glenda, G-L-E-N-D-A, dot Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, at cms.hhs.gov.
Hey, that'll be great. I think the problem is the company end up picking up that 20% that Medicare doesn't pay. And a lot of people get Medicare and think that's going to cover everything, and it doesn't.
Okay. If you email me your question, I'll forward it.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Other people have questions and you don't have an opportunity to ask them today on this call, you can also feel free to email your questions to Elizabeth D, that's Elizabeth D as in David, at kidney.org. We'll take our next question, please.
Martin Weinschenk, your line is open.
I wanted to tell you how much I appreciate being a part of this call. I have three questions, and they're different. Each one is different. First, what is the requirement for the care planning meeting frequency? I'm on nocturnal. I don't always see the medical director. I don't always see the dietitian or the social worker. The second question I have is for home dialysis, what is the frequency of treatments per week? You know, everything I've read, it's better to do 7 times instead of 3 times. It's better to do 8 hours rather than 3 hours. and it's confusing to me on what that regulation should be. And the third one, what is the minimum URR? I know what I've heard is 1.2, but everything that I've read, it seems like it should be 1.4 or even higher.
Glenda, would you like to respond to Marvin's questions? Glenda?
I'm sorry, I put myself on mute. That didn't work very well, did it? Yes, I'd be happy to respond. The care plan meeting frequency, first of all, it's changed with the new regulations. The old regulations, the care plans were at least every 6 months, and for unstable patients were monthly. With the new regulations, the care plan meetings have to be annually, and for unstable patients every 6 months. So if you are don't have any major serious problems going on from month to month, then probably to get you started in the new system, your care team should schedule an appointment with you to discuss your care plan and then move you into this new system. We're giving all the facilities a year to change over to this new system, so if you're a stable patient, it might be several months before they have that meeting. Then the home dialysis frequency per week, part of this is a reimbursement question, and as you might have noticed, I don't know a lot about reimbursement because that's not my area, but Medicare typically pays for 3 treatments a week. With some justification, they'll pay for a 4th treatment a week. The number of hours and times you should dialyze is really between you and your physician. Many people think shorter, more frequent treatments are great. Other people think longer and more frequent treatments are great. With nocturnal, I know that many times the blood flow rate and the dialysate flow rate are slower, and so that means you need a longer treatment to get the same clearance. And many times nocturnal is done more than 3 times a week. But again, I would refer you back to your physician as to what's the best for you. The minimum URR, the number you gave, 1.2, is actually back to that KT over V that Celeste mentioned early in the call, and it's a little bit more sophisticated a measure. The URR stands for urea reduction rate, and that minimum number is 65%. And what that means is that your blood urea nitrogen, yours, before treatment, is reduced 65% by that individual treatment. The KT over V uses the volume of urea inside your blood plus your weight and the time that you're on dialysis. So you can see it takes more components to calculate that. And the KT over V, the minimum for that is 1.2, but we talk about 1.4 being prescribed in order to obtain the 1.2. And it's prescribed by your doctor saying, okay, we need this size dialyzer and this much time and this blood flow rate and this dialysate flow rate in order to get to that kind of clearance. Both KT over V and URR are both about how well the artificial kidney clears your blood of toxins during your dialysis treatment. Did that help?
Yeah, I was mistaken. I meant KT over V.
No problem.
Right now, I'm a little concerned about the meeting for care planning. It wasn't so much care planning, but also how often you should have conference meetings between a dietitian, social worker, and medical director. And I had been used to once a month, and now it's pretty rare when I see anybody because of nocturnal.
Well, I hear you, and that certainly is a concern we have about nocturnal patients, that being a nocturnal patient does not mean that you don't see the care team. They need to look at their own schedules and figure out when they can manage to come later in the day or earlier in the morning.
But is there a minimum frequency?
The minimum for physicians, a physician or a physician practitioner, non-physician practitioner, such as a physician assistant or advanced nurse practice
practitioner are supposed to see the patient monthly. Now, that might not be in the dialysis center. That might be in their office. But they're supposed to see you at least monthly, and that some of those times it should be while you're on dialysis. Now, some of those times is not defined. Expected that would be at least quarterly. The dietitian and social worker, when they should see you, really depends on what your needs are and what the policy of the facility is. We would expect that there would be ongoing needs and that you would expect to see those individuals as your needs dictated. And we wouldn't know what your needs were if they only saw you once a year, because they wouldn't have any way to know whether you needed them, right?
Correct.
So we'd be expecting them to see you more frequently than that.
And Glenda, if I could just add to what you're saying, doesn't that also have to do with what's written in your care plan? Because if you do have a problem, or in the initial assessment that's been identified as something the social worker would help you with, then that has to be followed through with.
Absolutely, Sheila, you're correct. And even if it's not in your care plan, but you as an individual express a need to talk with a social worker, then that should be addressed, and that should happen. That we CMS expect the social worker and the dietitian to be available for every patient as they are needed.
Thank you for your questions, Marvin. Before we take the next question, I would like to ask participants if you could limit it to one question per participant. That way we can give as many people as possible an opportunity.
Hey, Sheila?
Yes.
This is Celeste, and I am really, really sorry, but I'm going to have to get off the call now just because I'm being summoned in my job here, and I need to get back to it. But can you, if someone had a specific question for me to answer, I would be more than happy to have Sheila, you know, to have them email it to me and that I could respond directly to them.
Well, thank you, Celeste. We appreciate the time you were able to share with us on this call. If any of the participants do have a question for Celeste, please feel free to send it to Elizabeth at elizabethd@kidney.org, and we'll make sure Celeste gets your question.
And I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And Sheila, if you could just explain to them the type of job I have, unfortunately. Sometimes it's not my own, but I wish you all well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Do we have any other questions?
Yes. Darlene Fletcher, your line is open.
Hi, Darlene.
Hi. My question is this, because my experience is similar to Celeste. I was on dialysis for almost 7 years. I've had my transplant for 10, but now my creatinine is increasing. It's at 3. And so I know in my future I probably have to go back on dialysis. But since I've been away from the dialysis scene, I have a question pertaining to, when do I go on dialysis? Because before, when I was on dialysis, I heard of horrible stories where the patient was told by their doctor a month or two before they needed to go on, oh, I think it's time for you to go on dialysis. I don't want that to be me, because I'm a person that advocates for myself, and I want to be well informed, because I know I have choices. I can pick my own unit. So when do the doctor... when do you get to the point where you need to start doing dialysis so that I can prepare for it with a fistula or a graft or so forth, because I don't want to be left in the dark?
Eileen, that's an excellent question, and something that obviously a lot of people who have chronic kidney disease stage 4 want to know about. And the National Kidney Foundation developed clinical practice guidelines that help make recommendations to doctors and help them to know when it is appropriate for a patient to get ready for starting dialysis. Now, one of the ways that we determine how well the kidney is functioning is by a measure that's called GFR, and that stands for glomerular filtration rate. Now, the National Kidney Foundation clinical practice guidelines say that when the GFR has fallen below 15, that's when you have kidney failure. and you need to be on some kind of kidney replacement treatment, such as dialysis explantation. Now, certainly you want to start planning before your GFR goes below 15. So that would be when you're in stage 4, and that's when your GFR is between 15 and 30. So the way you need to talk to your doctor about your GFR, and that's a measurement that's easily calculated. We actually have a GFR calculator on our website, and that measure does use the serum creatinine. The calculation uses the serum creatinine. So the National Kidney Foundation Clinical Practice Guidelines recommend using the GFR to determine what your kidney function is, and you should be talking with your doctor when you're in stage 4 about kidney replacement treatment.
Okay, so you said that there was a website that I could go to?
Yes.
Okay, what is that website?
Go to www.gfrcalculator.org.
Okay, and also, what was Glenda's email address again?
That would be Elizabeth.
Glenda.
Oh, I'm sorry, Glenda's. Did you say Glenda or
Glenda.
Elizabeth?
That would be Glenda, G-L-E-N-D-A, dot Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, at cms.hhs.gov. I don't know if your transplant center does glow field clearances. Do you know what that is?
You know what? I'm not even at a transplant center yet.
Oh, okay. Not
I'm just seeing my nephrologist at her clinic.
I see. Okay. Okay.
Okay, so I have a question to tell you, Glenda.
Okay, Fine. I'd like to hear from you.
Thank you. Randy Murley, your line is open.
Thank you. I just have one question. I've been on dialysis since 1975. I've had three transplants, with one of them lasting a year. I've come through dialysis from the old days, which it was hospital-based, to now where it's clinic here, clinic there. When is the National Kidney Foundation, I guess, going to come up with a ruling on reused kidneys? I'm not aware of one. And in our first clinic, the new patients that come in are scared to death because it's a life-changing thing. And they are looking for the truth and a warm heart. And the staff there, they're expecting them to tell the real thing. Well, we have, our clinic has this booklet that has all the different information in it, and the staff person normally sits down instead of letting the person read it themselves, reads it to them, and when they come to the reuse, they just say, we're reusing kidneys. They don't tell what the possible side effects are, and the standard protocol is the person comes in, whether they have a permcath or if they're lucky they have a fistula, most don't. And the first thing they do is they start with reused kidneys, and the permcaths don't work too well, so they're constantly trying to get their blood flows up, which they don't, and they clot off or whatever, and the dialysis unit won't get paid, they say, by Medicare, unless the KT over V is 1.2. So once they do get a access, then they start out with 17-gauge needles, and they, as soon as they can, up the needles, which usually destroys the graft a lot of times. And I've been told here the last year or so is if a person asks that they not have a reused kidney, then they will grant that wish. It took me 2 years. I almost got divorced because the medical director was overruling my doctor. These people have their jobs on the line, and whatever the company says goes, they're not going to buck and tell the patients the truth because they'll either be frowned at or they may lose their job. So again, when is the National Kidney Foundation going to come up with a ruling that reused kidneys should be, there's some way that the person has been told about reused kidneys and what the consequences might be? At our unit, used to, if the kidney didn't pass, they'd run it 5 or 6 times. I've even heard of them popping the top off and picking out the clots. And to me, dialysis, my disease has been easier than dealing with the establishment. And the only reason I'm alive is because I refused and I fought and I fought and I fought.
Randy, thank you for your question. It raises some important issues, and it sounds like you have been an excellent self-advocate during the many, many years that you've had kidney failure. The new conditions for coverage do address reuse issues, and Glenda, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, and I very much appreciate your story as well. The conditions of coverage adopt a document that was created by a group that's called the Association for the Advancement of Medical Instrumentation, also known as AIME, as an acronym. And it's a voluntary group that's made up of representatives of the industry, but also representatives of federal agencies like the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, and CMS. And in about 1986, that group developed guidelines, if you will, or standards for reuse of hemodialyzers and hemodialysis supplies. Those standards were adopted as regulation. There have not been any research studies that prove that reuse, if done correctly, is hazardous to patients. Certainly, any process that's not done correctly could be hazardous to patients. There are no states that forbid the practice of reuse. Again, CMS has a condition now in the conditions of coverage for reuse and reprocessing of hemodialyzers. And we look carefully at that practice in dialysis facilities. There are almost 100 different items that have to be checked to be sure that the facility is doing that properly. You are, as a patient, you have the right under our conditions to be informed about the reuse practices of a facility, and that you would be informed about what the risk and benefits to you were of the reuse process. We don't have language that says you must consent to the reuse process. Most facilities do give patients the right to refuse reuse or the right to choose either home therapy or transferring to a unit that does not reuse.
That still doesn't... Most patients, I'll just say this, most patients that come in there are scared to death. They're looking for the truth. And it's been my experience, I've dialyzed all over the country and been at this for a long time. And they're not told the truth.
Well, Randy, we hope that with the new conditions, you will see some changes in the way staff communicate with patients, because these are the kinds of things that surveyors will be looking for when they go out to survey facilities. In addition to that, the National Kidney Foundation has a brochure that explains reuse, and we'd be happy for you to request it or any of the other participants. You can call the National Kidney Foundation at 1-800-622-9010. I think we have time for one more quick question. Do we have another question?
I'm showing no other questions queued up at this time.
Okay, well then I will take this opportunity to thank our call participants today for joining in on our Coffee House Conversations Conditions for Coverage call.
How many participants were there online?
That
I can get that after the call.
Okay, thank you. We ask that you fill out a survey about this call so that we can learn more about what we can do to improve these calls and better meet your needs. If you go to the website www.nkfcoffeehouseconversations.org, again, that's all one word, nkfcoffeehouseconversations.org, you can either complete the survey online or you can print it out and fax it to us, and the fax number is on the survey. Also, if you visit that website, you can sign up for our next Coffee House Conversations call, which is Your Safety on Dialysis, Home and In Center. And that call is scheduled for Tuesday, December 9th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, that's Your Safety on Dialysis, Home and In Center, Tuesday, December 9th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We hope you will join us next time, and we look forward to hearing from you again. Thank you very much, and thank you to our faculty panel.
Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect from the audio portion, and thank you for your participation.